And yeah, so I've been told that it's not good to start your talk with caveats, but I'll do it anyway. So the first thing is, so my day job is, I'm a theorist, but this is, like me looking at an experiment from a theorist perspective. So usually nothing very good comes out of that, but it is usually very detrimental. But here we learned something interesting, and that's what I'm going to present to you. So yeah, so I'm going to be talking about some new ideas about interferometry, radio interferometry, and how they are relevant to measuring the global 21 centimeter signal. So I'm going to assume that not everyone here is intimately familiar with radio interferometry or the global 21 centimeter signal. So I'll introduce everything. And the second thing is, so this is a very theoretical sort of result, but in order to understand that, you should really know the background well. So I'll spend a lot of time on the introduction so that you get to know what I'm talking about. All right. So before I begin, so these are my collaborators, Zhu Qing at ASIA, Olivier at JPL, and Chris Hirata at OSU. Right. So let's begin with an outline. So I'll start by telling you even if you know, like what the global 21 centimeter signal background is from the dark ages and what does it tell us. And then I'll go to what are the current ideas on how to measure it and why would you want these new ideas. And then I'll talk about a different picture of radio interferometry from the things you're traditionally taught which is in books. And I'll use that to show something non-trivial about this idea. And I'll finish with an outlook. So, so let's begin with the 21 centimeter background. So this is the usual slide in 21 centimeter cosmology, except instead of taking it from Avi Loeb's paper, I've taken it from Discover magazine. Yeah, so this is the timeline of the universe with the scaling slightly changed to emphasize like the higher redshifts. So this is the CMB, which we all know and love, which tells us something about the universe before and after through primary and secondary anisotropies. And these are at late times. You have galaxies, and galaxy surveys tell us a lot about the clustering of matter and through that, again, the primordial universe. But there is this so-called redshift desert in between where you don't really have a good probe of this time. And what the 21 centimeter cosmology's selling point is, or what it promises to do, is open up this age for exploration. So I'll just begin with the physics of the 21 centimeter line. So this is a hyperfine line which arises because of the hyperfine interaction between the hydrogen atom's nuclear spin and the spin of the 1s electron. So since both of these are spin half, so when you add them, you can either get the spin 0 or 1 state. So spin 0 is the singlet, and the spin 1 is the triplet, which has degenerate. And they're separated by 5.9 micro electron volts. And this is a very weak line because it's hyperfine splitting, right? There is no. So usually in this business, everything is parameterized with temperature, right? So this is the so-called spin temperature, which parameterizes the relative population of these two levels. So it's basically the ratio. You can think of it as the temperature of a heat bath with which the system will have to be in equilibrium to have the populations that it does. So it's not necessarily a physical temperature, as in it's not necessarily a temperature which is actually there. And it is set by whatever processes are causing transitions between the levels. So at these redshifts, there are mainly three processes which are of interest. One is atomic collisions, which is so whenever you have a gas of hydrogen atoms, say, so when they collide, every once in a while, the kinetic energy goes into exciting an atom between these two levels and vice versa. And because of this tends to set the spin temperature to the Maxwell-Boltzmann temperature or the kinetic temperature of the baryons. right? And then you have the so-called Wuthu's and field effect, which is a two-step process where you jump from here to 2p and down to the upper level. So it's normally not very important, but here it's important because this line is so weak and the Lyman alpha line is so strong. And that also tends to set it to the kinetic temperature. And then you have, in the absence of both of this, you have stimulated emission against the CMB photons, which tends to set it to the CMB temperature. So this shows the various temperature scales as a function of redshift. So the blue line is the CMB temperature, which goes as redshift. And then the green line is the kinetic temperature for a particular model, which at high redshift it matches the CMB temperature, and then due to adiabatic cooling, it departs from it until the sources of heating turn on, which we don't know exactly when that happened. And in general, the spin temperature will be something in between these two, depending on which effect is winning. So it starts out at, because of collisions, it's kept to the kinetic temperature until the universe becomes too dilute for that, goes back to the CMB temperature, and then the first sources of Lyman alpha photons turn on, and due to the Wuthu's and field effect, it goes back to the kinetic temperature, right? So, but the observable is the brightness temperature, which is, you don't directly observe the spin temperature, right? You observe the result of the CMB photons passing through this gas. Okay. Wuthu's and field effect.
Wuthu's and field. So what temperature does it basically
set us to temperature? So it basically sets it to the color temperature of the Lyman alpha line.
Okay.
But the Lyman alpha photons scatter so frequently with the molecules, sorry, with the atoms at these redshifts, that the color temperature of the line is essentially set to the kinetic temperature. So yeah, so what we actually measure is, or what we actually want to measure is the result of radiative transfer of the CMB photons passing through this gas. So you have, so essentially this causes an absorption or emission signature depending on whether the spin temperature is above or below the CMB temperature, or below or above the CMB temperature. And basically, anything which modulates the optical depth of the gas modulates this brightness temperature. So therefore, you have some fundamental constants which depend on atomic physics, and then a whole bunch of redshift dependent factors which just encode all the things which modulate the optical depth of the line. Right? So in order to visualize what this signal would be, I like this plot, which is from Rashid Sinai's paper in 1971. Which is, if you perform a thought experiment, that imagine you send a probe out into the intergalactic like void somewhere, right? And this is the spectrum of background radiation it will see averaged over all directions. So this is isotropic. So, you know, so you have the, by far the brightest thing is the microwave background in terms of photons, but in terms of energy, so this is the intensity per unit frequency. And if you look at intensity per log nu, then the infrared and optical are sort of almost equal or dominate. But the, yeah, so this line is at 1.4 gigahertz in its rest frame. So it lives somewhere here. And essentially what this brightness temperature is that, so there is some small deviation from the microwave background's black body, right? That's what it manifests as. And so this is around 26 millikelvin at redshifts 10, say, modulo these factors. And for reference, the microwave background starts losing to the background of integrated radio sources. You see around, so this is still in free space. So there's no galaxy here. This is all the sources, you know, like averaged over all redshift shells. And for reference, this turns out to be around a Kelvin, but as we shall see, that is not the dominant source of problems when we try to measure this. So just to reinforce it, just to reinforce what I was saying, this shows the deviation from the CMB black body as a function of frequency for a particular model of how reionization occurred. So at high frequencies or low redshifts, after reionization, there's no neutral hydrogen, so it's flat. And then you start getting. So this is essentially the previous plot, except I've computed the brightness temperature from the spin temperature. So at very high redshifts, when the collisions start becoming inefficient, you have this small dip. And then at intermediate redshifts, you have this stronger dip because the Lyman alpha photons turn on. And for reference, so at the Earth's atmosphere's plasma frequency is at around 50 megahertz. So that probably precludes the measurement of this on the Earth. So most global signal experiments, they aim to get this dip because that will tell you something about what drove reionization. Right? This is what we are after. So now let's talk about how you would measure such a thing. So let's see. So usually what people do is they have a single antenna. So this is like, for example, like the work of Judd Bauman, right? So I'll just briefly review how antennas work because it'll be useful to see that later. So I'm just showing some radiation field here with plane waves coming in as. So this radiation field is built from a superposition of sources at infinity, which we assume that the source at one angle is incoherent with the source at another angle. So essentially, you have a bunch stochastic sum of plane waves where this wave is not correlated with this wave, right? So each wave has some electric field, and the average of some two-point function gives you the Stokes parameters. So here, if it's unpolarized, then essentially the average of the electric field square gives you the intensity, or in units of temperature, it gives you the so-called sky temperature. So the sky temperature is a function of both the frequency, because it's not a real temperature, and the direction, right? So now let's put a small dipole antenna here, which I've shown this way. And this antenna has a cable which connects to it and couples to a receiver. And so the receiver gives out a waveform, which is a scalar, right? So the electric field has a polarization. So to form a scalar, you take a projection, right? So the antenna has a particular polarization, right? And also this performs a linear operation on the incoming electric field. So the output waveform is linear in the electric field. Of course, there is this response function which tells you how it responds as a function of frequency and direction. Right. So what we actually measure is not the waveform itself, that doesn't tell us much, but the power spectrum of the waveform. So if you separate it into its frequency components, the power tells you something about, so that is defined as the antenna temperature at a particular frequency. So the antenna temperature is built out of, essentially, you take two averages of this, right? You take two copies of these and average them, and you use the property that the electric field is incoherent between directions. So essentially, you pick up an integral over directions times the sky temperature in that direction times essentially mod f square, right? So this f is commonly called the amplitude response, and this a is the so-called effective area because it has dimensions of area. And so there is a fundamental identity in antenna theory, which is that the integral of the effective area over all directions equals the square of the wavelength. So I'll come back to this later, but essentially what this tells you is, under a homogeneous sky, and if your antenna has no extra amplification, essentially the antenna temperature equals the sky temperature. Right. So this sounds simple enough, right? So then why you just put an antenna there and you get the sky temperature. But yeah, it's not that simple. Right. So it's presented as various things in the literature. So if you actually look at, so there is this sort of seminal work in radio astronomy book by Krauss. So there he proves this from thermodynamic arguments. But usually people have internalized this, so they normalize it out. Right. So that is implicitly assumed in the usual thing. But this is a sort of a fundamental identity. And I'll come to this later. Right. So, okay. So before we move on, so I just want to comment a bit about this beam profile which entered. So the beam profile is a function of your antenna geometry. So depending on the dish you use, you have to solve Maxwell's equations, and that tells you the beam profile. So for example, if you have a circular slit, it's parameterized by diameter, and the beam profile depends on the diameter relative to the wavelength. So it's essentially a diffraction pattern of by the reciprocity theorem that the antenna receives as it radiates. So if you drive a circular slit, you get a Bessel function profile. And so you have a central peak and you have the secondary peaks. If you have a short dipole, so a short dipole is essentially a piece of metal with two arms, say, and the dimension of the dipole is much smaller than the wavelength. So this is an inefficient antenna, but its response is independent of wavelength, and the beam essentially is this well-known dipole pattern. So this is for a dipole pattern which is oriented this way. And if you have a thin slit, so have a rectangular thing with the transverse dimension very short compared to wavelength, then you have essentially almost one-dimensional profile. So yeah, so people have various reasons for choosing what they choose. So I'll talk about that a bit later, but I mean, here I just wanted to show where the effective area usually comes from. So this is the chime beam. This is how it looks. This is how it's supposed to look, right? So as I said, it's not as simple as putting an antenna out in the field and measuring it and measuring the power spectrum. And you have essentially a set of, I would say, four major pitfalls or four major difficulties which you have to overcome. So the first one is foregrounds. So as I said, the 21 centimeter temperature is, you know, like 26 millikelvin or something, right? But and the extragalactic foregrounds are around a Kelvin, but the largest contribution actually comes from free electrons in our galaxy spiraling around magnetic field lines, and the resulting synchrotron radiation is very non-thermal, but it's orders of magnitude brighter than the signal at this redshift, right? So it's around 400 Kelvin at the redshifts of interest, right? So but it's often, I would say that it's a slight misconception that by that, I mean, just that means, so in my view, just the fact that you have a 400 Kelvin background is not a problem at all, right? Which is, I would say, a misconception. Because you're not really interested in the mean, right? You're interested in that dip. You want to identify the dark ages, right? So let's say that you want to get a dip of 25 millikelvin and you have a bandwidth of 5 megahertz. So essentially all the frequency components between 5 megahertz in a window of 5 megahertz, you compress them into one. So you get multiple modes which you can, you know, average to get the answer at the central point. So the integration time you need is for a one sigma detection essentially means that your noise, which is the sky temperature divided by the square root of the number of modes, which is delta nu times delta t, should equal your step, right? And if you put this in, you get that you can get a 1 sigma detection of a 25 millikelvin step for 50 seconds of integration, right? So just the fact that you have a background which is orders of magnitude brighter is not a problem, I would say. Well, as long as it's smooth in frequency. No, so this is from this influential paper by Peter Shaver in 99. So this shows the derivative of this sky temperature as a function of frequency. So it's basically almost 2.5, but it varies slightly, right? So this is the synchrotron spectrum, and these are some fiducial models of reionization from, right? So this is the step you would expect. This is the signature of the dark star. Right, and
how many orders of magnitude is the background larger?
Yeah, so it's 400 Kelvin, and that is 25 millikelvin roughly. So it is, yeah, it's just that you have so many modes, right? So basically this paper, which sort of launched the whole global signal thing, was so influential because it just pointed out that the fact that you have the synchrotron is not a problem. Yes, yeah. But in general, from first principles, you know that the synchrotron spectrum is some smooth function of frequency. So if it's not 2.5, it will be some polynomial function is the. So usually, essentially, you have, when you calculate the synchrotron power spectrum, you get some, you know, each electron has some power law, and then it's convolved with the electron's energy distribution, and that essentially makes smoothens out everything.
The smoothness must break down eventually.
Yeah.
Are there any theoretical estimates of how smooth the synchrotron spectrum will be?
So, yeah, so this was, I think, a paper by Pengo, which calculated this. I don't remember the exact year, but it essentially showed that, yeah, that is not a problem. There are much bigger problems which I'll come.
On the other end of the spectrum, so the thing that's spreading out the atomic transitions line is Doppler shifts or something. I would have thought the thing we're looking for is, if there weren't any Doppler shifts or some of the type of events, it would be incredibly sharp. So all you have to do is look at that versus, you're right, very
well, but there is neutral hydrogen at a range of redshifts, right? So each of them is a narrow line, but you're summing over all of them.
Okay, so it's a redshift
for many
different things. Yeah. Okay. So, can you explain again what's the difference between A, B, and C?
Yeah, so A, B, and C are some models of reionization, because basically we don't know anything about that dip when it occurs, right? Because when the first sources turn on is sort of unknown. So they just took some reasonable models and showed that for any model, this wasn't a problem.
And the data points there?
Oh, so this is the synchrotron with, so this error bars are essentially this thing for.
The fair part to show would be also three different models of synchrotron and see how they
can be. As I'd say, like, there are much bigger problems. I'll. Yeah.
But you might not be able to predict the 2.547.
Yeah.
But if you made the special rating for the, if you can be able to make the special rating, yeah.
No, but not again, it's not certain. It could be also different on that. Because so the thing is, the spectrum of electrons, we don't know exactly what it is. So the question is, if you change the spectrum of characteristic electrons, why?
Well, so, I mean, that's basically the problem I'm going to tell is. Right. Wait. So yeah, let me just, I'll tell you. Right. So this is a measurement by Bauman and Rogers of the temperature as a function of frequency. So this was the one where they put a limit of 0.06 and redshift for the reionization width. So I mean, it deviates from a power law because of their amplifier's response, and these spikes are RFI. and recombination lines. So they excise them, and essentially you can see that it's a smooth function at up to the precision at which they could do it. Right. But so. Oh, this is a this is edges. So this is a single antenna. So tentatively, I'll put a green light for foregrounds. But then there is this varying foregrounds, which is what we'll come to, which is that. So let's go back to the sky temperature as a function of the, antenna temperature as a function of the sky temperature and the beam pattern, right? So the sky temperature is, as I said, this is the fit for the mean synchrotron spectrum. But unfortunately, right, in reality, the synchrotron, the electron's energy distribution varies with position on the, varies with direction on the sky. So in reality, you have some modulation, and essentially the beam profiles which I showed earlier, they change with wavelength. So this is, for example, a map from this paper by Oliveira Costa, which is used for all these 21 centimeter foreground estimations. So this is not exactly this. So what they do is they take all the measurements of the sky and do a principal component analysis. And this is some combination of their PCA vectors, which corresponds to what you would think of synchrotron. And this shows how that combination varies as a function of angle on the sky, right? So you see that this is definitely, it has a lot of structure. And so let's take, for example, this beam, right? So this beam has side lobes. And if you put this on the sky and integrate it against it, essentially this varying sky temperature as a function of direction, it gets into this beam, right? And because of this, it departs from the simple sky temperature model you had. And in fact, this is one of the biggest problems facing these experiments, and not the mean signal. So, and I would say that they, you know, it's also not very sophisticated the way they deal with it. So they just assume that what this does is it changes the power law by, it adds extra terms, and they take a number of polynomials and try to fit it out. So let's assume that so if your instrument were truly perfect, according to them, you would just get one term in this expansion. And then because of their instrument not being perfect, you get a number of these terms, is what they say in their paper. So in order to check that, what they do is they take this model and they take a sky and convolve it with their beam and take the residuals. And so they fit for these parameters and see if that takes away the major component of their. Yeah, so the capital N is up to how many terms in the, you know, so if N is 6, you are keeping 6 terms in your expansion. So this is not very sophisticated.
I don't understand where this is related to spatial structure. If the AI coefficients are functions of spatial location?
Yeah, so so the first thing is, this is just a heuristic model they take, where essentially the functions of spatial locations, they give rise to AIs which are constant in direction for them. I actually don't see that. I think this is just something they do because they can do it.
Do you have a better alternative?
No, I don't have an alternative for that. The AIs are functions of position if the Earth rotates. So for a given sky, they have a particular AI which they fit, because you just have one. So you're not pointing your antenna, you have one antenna.
If I understand this correctly, there are
I'm actually not familiar with this paper, but it sounds like you're saying they're assuming at every point on the sky the temperature is a power law, but then when you convolve with this frequency dependent, the frequency, if you get some non-power law function frequency,
yes, 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 yeah. I mean, it's very simple because you just have one antenna, right? You're not pointing it.
Yeah, okay, I can understand that.
Yeah.
So I guess I just want to say this drives the previous point I was making, that the fact that you have different powers in different directions probably means in one direction is not a single power, because the reason it's different powers in different directions that you have different
parts
of electrons. Yeah. But along the line, one line also has different parts of electrons.
Yeah.
So the same type of deviation from power law you get even in one.
Anyway, so this is their heuristic model for how this would work. And so in order to check this, they take a model sky, they take this Haslam. So first of all, their model skies are even not realistic. So they take the Haslam map, which is at one frequency, and extrapolate it to all frequencies. And then they convolve it with their beam function. And then they try to fit this and try to remove it and see and minimize the residuals. And they look at the residuals as a function of your rotating sky, right? And so this is what they see. This is for various antennas. And this is as a function of latitude and sidereal time. And the colors show the residual between the, like, you know, the thing which they cannot fit with this dependence as a function of the, as the sky rotates around the direction of the antenna zenith. So in general, they get some things which go up to few tens to hundreds of millikelvin, right? And I mean, partly this is because I would say that they're not even using the proper sky model, but this is basically saying that, you know, if we don't worry for now about how you would solve this problem, this is basically saying that this is a problem, much more so than just a mean signal, right? So.
This is a kind of a strange thing to plot. Like, I'm not sure how to interpret this as a failure of the beam convolve signal to be sufficiently distinguishable from one, or if I should just interpret this as
Yeah, this is how, this is the residuals of, you know, for this fit.
Yeah, it's more like just a
failure. Yeah, yeah.
So if you add enough parameters, they will be less
common. Yeah, but I don't think it, after a point you just lose. You're here, I think they are using 6 terms. So I would say, you know, without going into further detail, that would be a problem. Right? And then the next thing is Johnson noise. So this is a consequence of the fluctuation dissipation theorem, where if you have a lossy element in your setup, it will also exhibit at a finite temperature, it will exhibit thermal fluctuations of the dipole moments inside, and because of this it will emit some noise. So this is essentially, you can show that this leads to, if you have a resistor R at 0 Kelvin, and if you instead have it at some finite temperature T, then if you measure the voltage across that resistor, it's a stochastic function, and so, and you have a certain power as a function of frequency, which is described by a noise temperature. So usually, So if your setup is at 300 Kelvin, right? So this essentially adds a 300 Kelvin baseline if you are picking up your resistors radiating themselves. So they solve for this by switching between the sky and a reference noise source. So they have some calibrated resistance which is emitting some noise, and they switch between that and the sky. And they, whatever is the contribution of the resistors inside their setup, they subtract it that way. So this, I would say, is not a huge problem. But one of the biggest problems in this, which is, I would say, equal to varying foregrounds, is internal refractions, which arises because you are calibrating you have nothing to calibrate it against. So here, so this is a model of the Bauman setup, which shows the antenna here, which goes to a switch, which goes to an amplifier, and then they have this noise source which they switch between to remove the, you know, the thermal noise which I just talked about, and then you have a bunch of electronics here, right? So let's see what the antenna is. So from the perspective of the wire which is connecting to the antenna is impedance, which is some ZA. So I'm in Canada, so I can say Z. And then the cable has a characteristic impedance, ZC, which is, so for a typical coaxial cable, it's like 50 or 75 ohms, right? And then, so this leads to a reflection coefficient, which says that if you send in a pulse from this side, if the antenna impedance does not match the cable impedance, some of the power is reflected back, right? And then you also have some input impedance for this amplifier. So this is from the perspective of the cable, what is the resistance of the load it sees, and it comes with its own reflection coefficient. So what does this lead to, right? So let's see. So this is plotting the antenna's reflection coefficient, so of the antenna as seen from the cable, as a function of frequency. So it has some very alarming frequency dependence. So this is the real and imaginary parts. So essentially, if you match it at one frequency, it becomes very hard to match it at all frequencies. So you have a very narrow window, right? And so this is the, again, the same plot except for the resistors. So the resistors have impedance which is not a big function of frequency. So this voltage reflection coefficient of the amplifier as seen from the wire is relatively well behaved. But essentially what happens is, so you essentially have a cavity here, right? And it has some resonant modes. So even if you send in a spectrum of perfectly smooth radiation, the coupling will be very strongly frequency dependent because of these reflection coefficients. So this shows the response if you just leave it open in a thermal bath as a function of frequency, and you can see the standing waves, right, which is essentially the cavity modes. And so this is a frequency dependence which is spurious, which is not a function of the sky, right? And this actually, so in this paper they show if you change these reflection coefficients by a percent in amplitude or phases by 0.01 radians, you change it by factors of order, you know, few hundred millikelvins, which is worrying, right? So you really need to calibrate this well to remove them. And so if you have a small error in that back propagates into your model. And currently there is no big, but you know, nice. Yeah, so usually you have a network analyzer, which they just plug it in and it sends pulses and calibrates it. But it will have some error in that. So if your error is, so if you're off in your calibration of the voltage reflection coefficient by a percent, it leads to, depending on the size of this thing, it can lead to a few hundred millikelvins. Right. So this is a big problem. So after the result in 2008, I would say that this area has remained largely static because of this. And until recently, when there was a whole bunch of new ideas which were put forth by people. So all these ideas involve interferometry. So once again, I'll explain very briefly how interferometry works. So this is the same setup as earlier with these plane waves and this antenna sitting here and this output voltage signal, except now you have two of them, right? And so what happens is that the same plane wave coming in from the same direction has a phase difference between, because of the arrival times being different, and that leads to this, each of these signals being phase offset, right? So this is, and if you, and in general, I've also included here the possibility that the performance of this antenna has changed because of the other one. So this amplitude function is, you know, different for different antennas. But if the amplitude function is the same as the one we calculated in the single antenna case, then if you take the average of the, if you take the cross correlation function or the power, cross power between these two waveforms, then you get the same thing as earlier, right? The integral over angles and the times the effective area and times the sky temperature, except you have this extra phase factor which comes from this term. And so this gives you, so this is, this tells you something different than just the single antenna experiment, because you can resolve spatial structure, right? So with this in mind, let's look at three, let's very quickly look at three interferometric methods which have been proposed in the, like, last year. So let's first talk about, so this is what I would call packed interferometers. So where, so this is by Aaron Parsons group. So this is the same equation I wrote earlier, which is the cross correlation function. You know, you have this phase factor, and here I've just plotted this, this, these factors as a function of angle on the sky, right? And essentially what they say is that if your sky temperature is uniform, say, right, so it comes out of the integral, then you have an integral over your beam times this exponential factor. So even if the sky is uniform, you can get some non-zero answer depending on your beam. So an easy way to think about it is in the flat sky approximation, where, which is not good for the global signal, but still. So where this, this integral becomes a Fourier transform, right, because it's just a plane surface. And what the visibility is, the convolution of the Fourier transforms of the beam and the sky at the baseline or at the separation, right? And if the sky is uniform and it comes out, but the beam has some spatial structure, this can have some component at this separation, even if the sky is, so this is what they, so, you know, so as you can, as you know, like, you know, so this group is involved in building, like, you know, interferometers to measure spatial structure and not the monopole. But so they raised this interesting idea as to whether they could retrofit their experiments to measure the global signal using this property. So if they do this optimization, they find that it works best if the antennas are close together, because this Fourier transform of the beam function falls away as a function of, you know, like, the where you evaluate it. So if you evaluate it close together, then you can get a few before it decays. Right. So this is,
so maybe there would be some sweet spot where the baseline is not so long that the signal is very suppressed, but long enough that it's not much
possible. Yeah, so this is, so yeah, so this is their idea. Okay. So this is, let's call it idea one. So idea two is what I would call a, so they call it a zero separation interferometer, or it's essentially a beam splitter. So what they have is they have two antennas and they have a screen in between, which is partially reflecting and partially transmitting. So you have radiation which is incident from, let's look at the signal from antenna A. It has something which is transmitted, which is reflected from direction one and transmitted from direction two. And the signal in antenna B is reflected from here and transmitted from here, right? So you have, and it's a function of this complex reflection and transmission coefficients. So if you take the uniform sky, so that these, the electric field averages just give you a sky temperature, then this cross correlation essentially picks up this factor which has some, which is dependent on the reflection coefficients, right, times the sky temperature. So if you solve Maxwell's equations for a metal plate, right, then you'll get that this angle is pi by 2. So for a metal plate, you don't get any signal. So in order to get any signal, you need this screen to be lossy. So beta minus alpha departs from pi over 2, or equivalently what happens is mod of the reflectivity square plus transmittivity square is not unity. And when they do their optimization, they find that this works best if the screen has an is, so you model the screen as being made of a bunch of resistors in lattice. So they take, if they say that this works best if the resistance of the lattice is half the impedance of free space, like 477 ohm by 2. And then again, you have a problem that you have correlated noise here, right? That the resistors will emit into both of these. So you'll get 300 kelvin spuriously. But so this is a second idea. Right? So, and then let's look at third interesting idea, which is from the LOFAR people. So this is lunar occultation. So this shows, so they have centered their visibility calculation on the position of the moon. And this is as a function of frequency. So at radio frequencies, the moon is approximately a black body with 230 Kelvin. And essentially this differs from the global background, whatever it is. So if you look at the signal picked up by the interferometers, this, because of the moon being there, it introduces a spatial structure in the global signal. So you know, if the global signal is 26 millikelvin, says it will be 26 millikelvin and then 230 Kelvin and so on. And then this, since it's a spatial structure, their interferometer can measure it. So essentially the occultation gives rise to some visibility because of the spatial structure, right? And they obviously, for this you need to, if you want to recover the sky temperature, you need to know the moon's temperature accurately. And right, so you need to construct a noise model for the moon, right? Because the moon, it actually turns out that this is not okay to the precision you want. So then they, you know, they assume, if they take the geometric cross section of the moon, and because the moon reflects some radio RFI back to the earth, right? So, and they try to subtract that, and they get some result, which is the global signal as a function of frequency, which is a lot worse than the single antenna experiment, but this is, they say that it suffers from different systematics. Right. And so this is the third idea which has come up in the last year. So there is, yeah, so I mean, when you start looking at this, there is something odd about all of this, but you can't put your finger on it. Right. That's how I was motivated to start working on this. So before I get to, you know, like before I talk about how these are all related, I'll just, you know, I spent so much time talking about the pitfalls of a single antenna experiment. I'll also briefly mention the problems of interferometers. Right. So this is again the same setup, which is these two antennas looking at the sky and on a ground. So typically they try to put antennas on a metal plate so that the ground loss does not affect the performance, but it's not perfect. So it sees some of the resistive ground. So you can get two kinds of spurious correlations. The first one is antenna crosstalk. So if you have some Johnson noise being emitted by a resistor here, and that will be beamed by this antenna and it will be picked up by the second one. And if you calculate the cross correlation, you'll pick up that modulo the how much it decays between going from here to here. So that is antenna crosstalk. The second thing is correlated input noise, which is, even if the antennas are magically designed so that they don't talk to each other, if you have some lossy ground, right, then this will emit, this can emit Johnson noise into both of them. So this is correlated input noise. So both of these are some sort of biases, right, for measuring any global signal or anything like this. So how are these So, you know, how important are these? So people have spent a lot of time thinking about how, you know, the problems of a single antenna experiment, but these, it turns out that these are, they have not reached the same level of code here. I would say that typically in the literature, people haven't thought about this to the same level of detail. So I'll just keep this in mind. So now I'll come to, after this long introduction, I'll come to I'll come to why I think, you know, all of these share some common things. And in true tradition, this begins by putting everything I talked about out of the window and looking at the thing in a different way. So maybe that introduction was for no purpose, but right. So let's first look at lossy materials. So I'll first begin by cataloging everything that the experiment talks to, right? So the first set of things it talks to is lossy materials like the ground, right? So in this lossy material, so let's assume that, for example, it's a resistor at some temperature, right? So, and assume that it's matched to a cable. So there is this noise voltage. And so this noise voltage leads to some power going into the setup. And this power has some power spectral density, which is given by the temperature of the resistor, right? So I can take this alternate model where what I do is I abstract away the resistor as a cable, right? So this cable has sent something into the setup. So it has some waveform, and the power is the waveform square, which is KBT. So from the perspective of this setup, which is after this lossy elements, it doesn't know the difference between these two. So from here on, I'll think of every resistor as a cable, which leads out of the system. So it takes stuff out, right? That is, it dissipates, but it also sends in noise, which is this input thing, right? And then the second set of things it talks to is the sky, obviously, right? So how do we deal with the sky? So this shows, so assume this is some spherical shell of the sky in the far field of the setup. And this is the origin, and this is some point where we're interested in the electric field. So for under the conditions which I mentioned about the generation of the electric fields, then the electric field at this point is given by the Kirchhoff diffraction integral. So this tells you, given given electric fields on this spherical shell, what's the electric field here? It's an integral over all these electric fields weighted by this, you know, Green's function, essentially, right? So how do I deal with this? So I'll first tell you where I'm going. So I don't like any physical system. So I want to, my game plan is to make everything cables because I like cables. So I want to replace the sky with a bunch of cables. So essentially I want to find a model with a bunch of cables that produces the same electric field at this point as the real sky does. So how do you do that? So I need to reproduce this electric field on this spherical shell, right? So this is like a fun Jackson problem. So what I do is, in the far field, I replace the sky with a lattice of resistors, and a quarter wavelength away, I put a metal plate. So what this means is that it absorbs everything which is sent in, right? So I adiabatically change the refractive index from unity to some large value so that any waves which are sent in, right, I want it to behave the same way for things sent in and sent out. So any waves which are sent in are refracted until they turn normal, and then they're absorbed, right? So this is some funny thing to do that. And So if the lattice of resistors is fine enough, then your experiment cannot resolve that. So there is some size S, and each resistor, as I mentioned, has some, you know, extra Johnson noise on top of it, which is a cable. And you can solve Maxwell's equations, and as a function of the, so you can get the electric field here as a function of the noise voltage in this resistor. And therefore, you can get a relation between the noise voltage and the power sent in here, which essentially substitutes this. So from the perspective of things sent in or sent out, your experiment cannot make out whether it is seeing the sky or whether it is seeing this, you know, whether, you know, everything is being by some super intelligent being is sending signals that look like a sky to us, right? But this is nice because I can take each of these resistors and replace them with a cable, right? So because of this, what happens is, so this is the same setup as I mentioned earlier, except by what I'm doing is that I'm replacing it by a giant linear blob. Apart from these two outputs, there are also the readout outputs, right? Which is what we are correlating to produce visibilities. So those are these cables, say. And then the lossy elements I have replaced with cables, right? And the sky I have replaced with cables. So this whole setup is a giant blob which has a bunch of cables. And by construction, there is no dissipation inside this blob, because I've replaced all resistors with cables, right? So what this is that this is a giant unitary matrix, which, so this whole setup has, in the language of particle physics, it has an S matrix, right? So where it performs a linear transformation on the input sent in into all its cables and gets outputs in all the cables. So I'm dividing this matrix into its sub-blocks depending on the cables. So you have the sky sub-block, which is something which is radiation which is sent in from the sky and reflected back to the sky, right? You have the sky dissipation thing, which is this noise which is radiated into the sky. You have the sky cable thing, which is normally what you are interested in, right? Which is your antenna response to the sky. You have the dissipation thing. You have the DC thing, which is the correlated input noise, right? Which is how much of your radiation is absorbed, or vice versa, how much is of the emitted radiation you pick up. And then you have the cable thing, which is crosstalk, right? Which is how much of an input radiation in this cable is picked up at this cable. So the common sources of problems are UDC and UCC, right? Those are the things, right? But so this is a neat way to look at it, but it turns out that it's more than a neat way. It tells you something fundamental about the problem. So let's see. So when you are trying to convert a set of signals in these cables to an output, you're essentially multiplying this column vector with this. This column vector is some bunch of amplitudes which are proportional to the square roots of the temperature. So there is a sky temperature in the sky block, and there is a noise temperature for your resistors, and then there is any signal which is sent in from the cables. So if your whole setup is at 300 Kelvin, both of these are at 300 Kelvin, and this is the sky, right? So for example, let's take a single matched antenna. So the antenna is impedance matched with the cable, and there is no dissipation, so it's above a perfect ground. So this goes away, and since there is no voltage reflection, this coefficient is zero, right? So essentially, this coefficient is telling you how much of the input thing is reflected back. Since both of these are zero, essentially the output antenna temperature is the dot product of this with this and it itself, right? So you recover the usual relation between the effective area and the sky temperature if you say that these elements are the amplitude responses as they are, right? And So now let's take two antennas instead, right? And again, no crosstalk, no dissipation. Then since these are offset by some phase, you get this usual visibility, right? And for free, you get the identity which I mentioned, which is that the integral of the effective area is the square of the wavelength. In this language, it just tells you that since this is a unitary matrix, the rows and columns are of unit norm. And if this is zero, this thing being of unit norm is essentially the condition on the integral of the effective area. It's the same thing, right? And this also tells you something deep about crosstalk, because assume that you have two antennas which are infinitely far apart, right? Suppose you start from there. So the UCC is zero. There's no noise anywhere. And these are given by the single antenna's responses. And then you start bringing the antennas together. So there are two changes which occur usually, which is the first thing is the antennas start talking to each other, which is this UCC, which is telling you how much of the noise which is sent in from one is sent, picked up by the other. And then the UCS are also modified, which is telling you that this antenna's response changes because of the presence of this one. So if you send in a plane wave, there are parasitic oscillations here, which this one picks up. So this tells you, but usually these two things are hard to compute. And you try as best as you can to calibrate this, the change in the beam response. So these are two different things, right? But this is telling you that they're related because the whatever it is, the whole thing is still a unitary matrix. So the changes will obey some law, right? So this is like an optical theorem for the setup, right? So now let's look at the problem of measuring global signals. So we are considering two channels again, and we're interfering them. So you're forming the average of these two channels, and these channels have both input and outputs. So you're taking the average of these two. And from the relations, from in the fact that this matrix relates this input and output. So if the input in one is talking to the output of the other, it is related by a off diagonal term, which is the crosstalk, right? And similarly, another term, which is the crosstalk. And then you have this term, which is the output in one talking to the output of the other, which is normally your visibility, right? And so now if you put this setup under a uniform sky, right, then you can do some simple algebraic manipulations, essentially subtract the uniform sky term from this, and you get some identity where the sky is removed because the sky channel doesn't come. So essentially the dot product of these two is minus the dot product of these two because of unitarity. So what you get is some relation for the cross correlation, where the sky has been the beam response to the sky has been taken out. You only get the, so this is in terms of the crosstalk and the correlated noise, right? So this is some identity which is telling you. So if you actually explore this further, what you get is, if you look at the various terms, you get that the cross correlation, how much it changes as a function of sky temperature, is a sum of three terms. And those three terms require one by one that there is some crosstalk between the two channels, that there is some other channel which exhibits crosstalk between these two, and that there is some element which emits correlated noise into both of these. So this is essentially saying that your signal is proportional to your systematic error, right? Which is yes, the signal is proportional to the extent you fail to zero these elements. Right, so that is commonly your systematic error for crosstalk and all. Right, so in that sense, this is very clear in the case of the moon, for example, because this whole thing does not demand where the resistors are. So from the perspective of this, the moon is a resistor in the sky, right? So and you are measuring the difference between the moon and the global temperature, which is essentially telling you the same thing here, that the size is the same for both of them. But it, this also tells you that if you come up with some creative experiment to remove the crosstalk, like for example in the packed antenna case, you will also lose your sensitivity to the same amount. So in another this has all been rather theoretical, so we also went ahead and calculated it for like some real antennas. So this is a case of two dipoles which are above a reflecting ground separated by some distance. So each individual antenna's beam, if it were alone, would be like this, say, right? And if you calculate the electric field because of one antenna radiating into the other, you get, because it's short dipoles, you can calculate everything. You get that it is the sum of two terms, one of which is the usual dipole radiation term, and one of which is the near field response. And you can explicitly verify that, so this is the sensitivity to the sky and noise temperature as a function of separation. So it's not quite exactly the same because there are extra terms, but it tells, but in general, you get that they both decay as the same in the same way. So if you go further out, you'll reduce your crosstalk or correlated noise, but you'll also reduce your sensitivity to the same amount. So the black ones are for two antennas above free space, and the blue one is for if I put them above a ground, because some of these experimentalists had the intuition that this sensitivity is coming up because you're not integrating above the whole sky, around the whole sky. So they had this idea that they would put their experiment at the bottom of a canyon and restrict the domain of their integration. But you can't get around it because the canyon also radiates noise into the setup and you get the same result again. So this is essentially telling you that any interferometric global signal experiment, when it is sensitive to the monopole, is effectively operating like a single antenna experiment. So since I'm not an experimentalist, I don't know whether to be happy or sad, probably sad, but one way to look at it, which experimentalists are thinking about, is that they have more handles to turn in an interferometer. So maybe they can come up with some better way of calibrating it. But what is clear is that in terms of sensitivity, you don't win. Maybe you win in terms of how easily you can get that. I don't know yet. But yeah, so this is just something fundamental about electromagnetism which gets in your way. Yeah. That's all. Right. So I looked at how people solve like antenna beams. So they have this software from 1986 called GRACE, which sends in a bunch of rays, because you have essentially you have a Dyson series which you have to sum, right? You have rays and then reflected rays and then reflected rays again, and it cuts it off after some term. So it the Yeah.
That's the thing that you say you cannot model, really.
Yeah.
So is that something that, is that classical Maxwell's equation or is that the quantum?
No, classical.
So you cannot just solve that. Yeah. I don't know. I'm speaking as a
student. Kitty Carlson speaks a lot. Like, he didn't used to be practical, so now he's speaking.
Well, I was told that apparently some applied mathematicians found some very good way to do this instead of sending these rays and doing the Dyson series. But apparently they charge like $300,000 for. Because it's a lot of money, right, antennas. Yeah. I think the experiments in this field, they don't really do that level of sophistication in their beam modeling.
What are the typical customers, these people who are
for telecommunications? Telecommunications.
I mean, we've had some qualitative success in China. We've tried this.
Uh-huh.
We can understand some qualitative features of our beam.
Yeah. Yeah.
I doubt we'll ever be able to have a full model of beam. I mean, uh-huh. I don't know. At least for us, like, the cylinders are just too complicated. There's like struts everywhere.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're saying basically the main problem is
staying
the background.
Yeah.
But the monopole.
Yeah. I mean, even without the monopole, this still tells you something about the elements of the unitary matrix which are independent of what signal you send in, right? That is a fundamental characteristic of the setup, which is there. Whether you're trying to measure a monopole or whether you're trying to measure a varying signal. But I mean, this cancellation occurs because of a monopole. So the varying thing helps you, but still the crosstalk terms will follow the same identities, which like the optical theorem, which I mentioned, will still hold.
Yeah.